From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A federal bankruptcy judge in Virginia today approved $75 million in emergency funding to allow U.S. Airways to pay suppliers, staff, and contractors while the company restructures its finances in bankruptcy. This weekend, bowing under the pressures of mounting debt and declining passenger rolls, U.S. Airways filed for Chapter 11. Industry watchers say U.S. Airways may be the first airline to cry uncle since the September 11th attacks, but more airlines may soon follow it into bankruptcy. Investors, nervous about the industry since stocks sliding today, with United Airlines shares down as much as 30% at one point before the close. It's almost a year since September 11th and its attacks sent this already sagging air industry into a tailspin. Today, every major U.S. airline except Southwest is losing money in spite of dramatic cutbacks, thousands of layoffs, and a $15 billion government bailout program. How much more will it take to get U.S. airlines back on their feet? Does America have a viable airline industry? And how much should the government and public funding do to save the industry from major restructuring? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Washington, D.C. is Steve Lott. He's business editor for Aviation Daily, the daily paper for the airline industry. Good evening and welcome, Steve Lott.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also with us is Elizabeth Warren. She's professor at Harvard Law School, specializing in commercial bankruptcy. Good evening and welcome, Elizabeth Warren.
Hello.
Hi. And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Where to dive in? Elizabeth Warren, let's start with you. We're going to look at the big issues in the airline industry tonight, but help us first understand what happens when a business the size of U.S. Airways goes into bankruptcy. We read that it has assets of about $780 million and debts of about the same. Will it emerge from this? Will it come through? Will it be the same as it is now? Will it be changed? What's the pattern likely to be?
Well, the first thing to understand is that when a great big company goes into bankruptcy, from the point of view of the public, that is, people who are buying tickets to fly on airlines and people who supply them with goods and services, don't see anything that looks any different. It's a lot of paper that was filed in Virginia. Where the big differences happen are that certain big things can't happen. Creditors can't move forward. They can't start seizing assets. In this particular case, the biggest thing that happens, it appears, with U.S. Air, when they filed, is that they already had funding in place so that they could get a new infusion of cash.
So this was no surprise. Everybody knew this was coming.
Right.
They'd already talked to the federal government about it, and they've been working behind the scenes to arrange fresh cash on the other side of the Chapter 11 filing for months now.
That's right. And it was the filing that triggers the ability to get that cash, though, because now this cash will be treated differently from all the other cash that the company has had before.
That is, old creditors don't have a claim on it.
Well, that's exactly right. These creditors will be paid ahead of the old creditors.
Is there a downside for U.S. Airways in going into bankruptcy, or is it all upside somehow?
Oh, no, there's a huge downside. I mean, the first one is how many people will pause in buying a ticket to go on an airline that's bankrupt.
Is that a reasonable pause in your estimation?
Well, it's probably okay.
They're saying it's okay. They're saying everything's going to go right.
What do you expect them to say? Are they going to say, listen, it's a terrible idea. There's a 50-50 chance there won't be a flight on this route a month from now when you're getting ready to fly? Of course they're saying it's okay because they've got to persuade the public to continue to do business.
But are the odds anything like 50-50 that it may or may not be there in your estimation?
A month from now, certainly. I think the odds are nothing like 50-50. I think that U.S. Airways is likely to be there for a long time. Will they be there on any given route in 30 days or in 60 days or in 90 days? I think now the odds start to shift a little bit.
Continental went into bankruptcy, came out and became very profitable.
Came out and went into bankruptcy again.
Well,
came out and then became very profitable.
What does that tell us? Is this a way of shedding burdens of debt that might, in fact, make it possible for U.S. Airways to come out healthy on the other side?
Well, the real question about whether a company can come out healthy on the other side in bankruptcy is not special to the airline industry. The real question is, what's the problem you're trying to solve?
Mm-hmm.
And if the problem you're trying to solve is overcapacity in the industry, for example, bankruptcy is not going to fix that. bankruptcy can help a little. It can hold off some creditors. It can let people get rid of some leases, and it may be able to help pressure the employees to cut back on some of the expenses. But bankruptcy really can't solve that problem. If the problem is a problem on paper rather than a big industry problem, mm-hmm. that is, if they have just way too much debt and they can't service their debt, then bankruptcy is a terrific solution. So whether or not bankruptcy works as a hammer depends on whether or not the airline has the right kind of nail. I mean, is that the right kind of problem to be solved?
Steve Lott, that sounds like where you come in is U.S. Airways, and I guess for that matter, are all U.S. airlines facing the kinds of problems that a bankruptcy filing can solve?
Well, to some degree they are. I think the major problems that many of the airlines face, U.S. Airways the worst of it at this point, is a cost issue. U.S. airlines in general face that the name of the game is keeping your costs low. U.S. Airways has traditionally, for years, have had very high labor costs, very high aircraft costs, leasing costs, these types of issues. At the same time, they face very intense competition from airlines like Southwest, AirTran, and JetBlue that have very low costs. They've had very tight cost control. Therefore, they have the definite advantage over U.S. Airways.
And over United Airlines, which is sitting right behind U.S. Airways in the expectation of a potential bankruptcy.
Exactly right. Ironically, it's the major powerhouses, the 600-pound gorillas, that are having the biggest troubles right now. It's U.S. Airways, United, American to some degree, all face a very high cost structure that's really dragging them down.
Why the huge differentiation in cost structures? Have these managers been somehow asleep at the switch, or what's created this situation?
Well, it's really just you have to look at the timeline of commercial aviation. A lot of these big airlines have reached this point through mergers, acquisitions, just general growth. United and American, for example, have picked up smaller airlines over the years and have grown. Their cost structures have grown. The types of fleet, the types of aircraft that they fly has increased to as many as a dozen different planes, which increase your maintenance costs and your flying costs, the type of pilots you have. So over the years, they've just bloated with all different types of fleets and planes. And in the happy times and the strong times, it hasn't been an issue. But now when the economy is weak, it's really dragging them down. And as we've seen since September 11th, the airlines have just gone through every portion of their operation and tried to take out as many costs as they can. They've retired different types of airplanes and really are trying to squeeze every nickel out of their operation.
How much of the cost difference is on the labor front? Do airlines like Southwest Airlines pay substantially less to their employees?
Well, it's hard to compare apples to apples because Southwest flies only one type of aircraft. It's a Boeing 737. As a result, they have a really, I don't want to say simple, but it's a fairly easy pay structure to understand. United, on the other hand, pays minimal salaries for pilots flying the small turboprop aircraft up to $250,000 to a captain flying a 747 wide body. So it's really a wide differential, which brings up, as you said, a very complex issue in the industry, which is labor negotiations and labor pay structures.
Steve Lott, step way back with us here. We went through a period of great deregulation. It included the airline industry. It brought some amazing fares in its wake. Does the trouble that the airline industry is in now, and it's important to remember that it was in trouble before September 11th, though that trouble deepened, does this trouble suggest that there's simply something wrong with the structure of the U.S. airline industry in total?
Many believe so. Many believe that, you know, over the years, since deregulation, the large airlines have developed what they call a hub-and-spoke system, mm-hmm. where all the flights come into one big city, one big airport hub, and a bunch of flights go out again. American CEO Don Carty, over the past few weeks and months, has suggested that we need to take a second look at that and see if that really is working for the airline industry. Many have said we really need to take a close look at the pay structure at the airline industry. So many executives are really at a loss as far as, you know, what should we do? They're raising their hands in the air. Again, I go back to American CEO Don Carty, issued a memo to employees worldwide and said, basically, you know, opened up a virtual suggestion box and said, if you have any ideas that we can improve the airline, reduce our costs, and improve the situation, please send it to me. I'm all ears. So there's a big question mark among airline managers at this point as far as what we can do. And again, we have such a wide range of airlines.
Mm-hmm.
It's the larger airlines that are finding the most trouble at this point. Southwest, as you mentioned in your introduction, is the only major airline that's remained profitable and is doing well. Smaller airlines, JetBlue, launched about 18 months ago and appears to be doing well. Appears to be making a profit and continues to expand.
So far, but we saw the president of the American Society of Travel Agents today, Richard Copeland, said there's a cancer out there that no one's addressing. The government gave the airlines $5 billion 10 months ago. What happened to the $5 billion? Doesn't anyone realize the business model isn't working? Jack Beatty, when you look at this industry, what do you see?
Well, I go back to the beginning of deregulation. We owe it to Senator Edward Kennedy and Stephen Breyer, the current Supreme Court Justice, and Alfred Kahn, who, as President Carter's head of the CAB, implemented deregulation. Kennedy and Breyer held hearings in 1975 in which they brought out that how the regulated industry had become a cartel. Since the industry, since the CAB had been formed in 1938, the same 16 carriers were still the trunk carriers. No one else had entered that game. And they lined up price differentials. They went to airlines that weren't regulated by the CAB, that flew intrastate, like Pacific Southwest in California. On their Los Angeles-San Francisco route, which was 338 miles, their fare was $18.75. Boy, okay. That was a long time ago. And then the regulated fare from Chicago to Minneapolis, the same amount of distance, was $38.89. Clearly, the competitive situation, the non-regulated, without the CAB saying you can't compete on price, was driving prices down. They estimated that just the 4 years from the 60s, passengers could have saved about $1.5 billion if there had been price competition. So that kind of dramatic testimony, plus the sort of impetus of the consumer movement, really made for the whole idea, let's get out of this business, let's deregulate, and let competition work.
But that makes it sound, Jack, like we don't want to go back to regulation with fares like that.
Yeah, but one of the things that's happened, I think, or is happening, I think, is that when industries with huge fixed costs like these compete on price, inevitably it means consolidation. Inevitably, consolidation means either at the end, monopoly or near monopoly. And that usually means higher prices. Therefore, the experiment in deregulation, which was to lower prices, may well result when all this gets shaken out, this overcapacity, this competition, you may just get two or three carriers who will raise prices. And that, I think, is the anomaly here of this experiment in deregulation.
Jack, you make it sound like we may get it coming and going. I want to ask Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth, have you seen examples in other industries where a major player goes into bankruptcy and as a result, maybe some others do as well, coming out, the industry's structure is changed overall, not simply that one company, but the whole structure?
Well, we watched it happen in the retail industry. We remember that there was this big spate of reorganizations and bankruptcies in the early 1990s. Remember when Macy's went in bankruptcy?
The big department stores, yep.
That's right. The big department stores went in, and everyone began to talk about the fact that maybe the big department store was a dinosaur, maybe it won't be here anymore. And ultimately, what most analysts concluded is there was simply too much retail space. And what needed to happen was shake some of that out and get rid of some of it. And so the big department stores used the opportunity to close off the unprofitable stores and to rethink how they worked. And a lot of the small stores moved in and advanced. That's when stores like the Gap and the Limited that preceded the Gap came in and became very big competitors.
So in a nutshell, bring it to the airline industry. Does that suggest consolidation maybe on the horizon, as Jack Beatty suggests, or something else?
Well, you know, I have to go back to my first point, and that is if no one knows what the answer is, then you can't expect the answer to come out of bankruptcy, except in the following sense. This is one of those cases where we now understand the patient is on the table. The monitors are going off saying that the heart is not going to be beating much longer. And so I think what's going to happen right now is we are going to see a drastic reshaping of U.S. Air. This is going to be one of those grand experiments.
Elizabeth Warren, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about U.S. Airways bankruptcy and U.S. airlines in trouble. You can join us. Do we have a sustainable airline industry in America? What is the problem here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about U.S. airlines in trouble. U.S. Airways has declared bankruptcy. It's gone into Chapter 11, says it will come out in fighting form. But who knows? What do you think? Do you feel well-served on American airlines these days? Which airlines do you think are going to last? And does the U.S. air bankruptcy suggest better flying days ahead to you or worse? What does the airline industry tell us about the viability of deregulation in the U.S. economy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Steve Lott. He's business editor for Aviation Daily, and Elizabeth Warren, professor at Harvard Law School specializing in commercial bankruptcy law. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Walter's on the line right now. Hi, Walter. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Am I on?
Yes, you're on.
It was hard to hear. Oh, we're on the air now.
You're live and on, Walter. Hi.
Yes. I was just listening to the questions during the break and what have you, and having been being very, I know the airline industry very well. I've been working for years and years. I've been a frequent flyer. I used to even live in the South, so I'm really familiar with U.S. Airways.
Okay.
But people are talking about, you know, all this consolidation and deregulation, but you even look at it should come as no surprise that an airline like U.S. Airways is in trouble, considering that they are an amalgamation of three or four mismatched airlines. I think U.S. Airways was a cobbled together of the Allegheny, Piedmont, and like All American, you know.
So you're saying consolidation doesn't work, Walter?
No, well, actually, I'm saying it does work. It's been going on for since the 1950s. I mean, most of the major airlines today are cobbled together two or three carriers, and they either run well or they don't run well. Let's look at an example like a larger carrier, like Delta, was originally a regional Southeast carrier, but then when Pan Am went out of business, they sort of, you know, cannibalized the airline, and Delta got the JFK route authorities to Europe.
And but they're all losing money, Walter, and they were in trouble even before September 11th.
Exactly, but that's the thing with consolidation in general. So, like, what will happen for like a player like U.S. Airways, which has been, like, you know, the other lady said, you know, dead on the table for a long time, no one's going to miss their departure. There's so much capacity in the airline industry now that, you know, the profitable routes and the good feeders and what have you will remain, and then the rest will just sort of, like, you know, go away, and no one's going to notice that, you know, we don't have five flights from Charlotte to Detroit because Northwest will fly it, you know, or maybe another airline will step in, but there's so much overlapping that it's not going to be negligible.
So you're saying we're going to have less air service, but people won't really notice it?
Well, especially like on the Eastern Seaboard, there's so much overlapping. I mean, people have been talking about, like, you know, we should be expecting higher fares, and the whole fare structure is very lopsided, and it's a really, you know, an old-fashioned business model, which is impossible hold up. You know, I'll agree with everyone who's been talking about that. But except for, like, for example, with U.S. Airways, the only routes that made that carrier any money and kept them profitable for years were just the shuttle routes. And everything else was a loser. You know, they had multiple hubs, a lot of short-haul flights, you know, with high labor costs, and never a really good, you know, transcontinental network, and never a really good presence in Europe. They did pretty well a long time ago when they had a relationship with British Airways, and then they, you know, U.S. Airways would feed the BA flights to Europe, and that worked out pretty good.
But, of course, their shuttle business got hurt very badly when Ronald Reagan Airport in Washington went down.
Exactly.
Steve Lott, respond to our caller Walter's observation here that we may see much less service to some smaller destinations, a kind of consolidation along those lines. Do you expect that in the years ahead?
Yeah, to some degree I do, although there are still, I think, many communities that will retain their service. The question is, what will happen to fares in many of those communities? A good example I always use is upstate New York with U.S. Airways. For a long time, U.S. Airways was really the only carrier in upstate New York that would serve a lot of those many small communities. We're talking about Buffalo, Albany, Rochester. And they're really, fares were very high, very exorbitant up to some of those cities. But over time, Southwest expanded. They now serve Albany and Buffalo. JetBlue now flies to Rochester. As a result, the fares have dropped dramatically. So I think even if we lose, for example, if U.S. Airways pulls out of some of those smaller communities along the Eastern Seaboard, we're going to see other airlines go in and take their place. So I guess the good news is for some of the smaller towns and cities is that they will probably see air service continue. It's just that, you know, at what airfare and to what frequency they may be getting service. And I do agree with the caller in that, we still have a significant amount of overcapacity, both domestically and internationally, more so domestically.
And as we iron that overcapacity out, does it mean that Americans in general are going to be looking at higher airfares? Is that inevitable or not?
No, I don't think it is inevitable, because I think the growth we're seeing now is among low-cost carriers. Again, back to Southwest, AirTran, mm-hmm. JetBlue. It's these airlines that are keeping the airfare lows. Of course, all those airlines would like to see fares creep up a little bit, but it's not going to be very dramatic, of a jump.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just, Southwest is going to keep overall, I think, pressure on airfares, and that's actually what's frustrating many of the larger carriers, is that their costs are so high, yet over the past year we've seen such aggressive fare sales from many of the low-cost carriers, is that revenues have come in significantly under.
Nothing spanning the gap there. Walter, I want to thank you for your call. And Steve Blatt, I want to put to you Jack Beatty's earlier observation that while deregulation regulation created some very odd fare situations, in Jack's view, deregulation has also led us to a pass where we may go back to consolidation, back to higher fares, back to less choice. It sounds like you may not be buying that.
No, I don't really buy that. I mean, I think many airlines would rather try to figure things out on their own than deal with regulation again. I mean, I think most of the major airlines would lobby heavily against any type of re-regulation, and then they really hope to iron out the situation on their own.
But they got a $15 billion bailout last fall. That doesn't sound like on their own. Can that be sustained if it's going to take huge infusions of federal cash?
Well, that's a good point. No one's mentioned yet, really, the fact that the airline industry is very cyclical. We can trace over 20, 30, 40 years the cyclicality of the airline industry, and we go through these ebbs and flows and these ups and downs. And currently we're in a down period, a very deep down period. But a lot of it is, again, tied with the economy, too. We're in a very difficult economic situation. And I think a lot of people are, keeping their fingers crossed that when the economy returns, some of that business travel will return and help prop up the airlines. Now, that doesn't mean we still need dramatic change, whether it's in airline labor costs or in their fare structure. But, things will come back. It's just a matter of when and how much.
Clearly, the lenders and investors who put $700 million on the table for U.S. Airways think so. Elizabeth Warren, I hear you there.
I was just going to say, though, it's interesting to me that there, in fact, sound like there are two models on the table.
Mm-hmm.
One is the consolidation model that you keep asking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in fact, it's my understanding for the last 2 years it was no secret that U.S. Airways was looking for someone to acquire it.
And they were very close to having that. It was United, and the government said no way.
That's right. And ultimately, others backed away.
Mm-hmm.
And the point that Walt and others have made, that U.S. Airways is itself an amalgam
mm-hmm.
of airlines that have been drawn together and maybe don't work efficiently for exactly that reason, that they fly different kinds of planes, they fly odd routes, they have different structures in terms of how they pay people. One possible solution to that is not the consolidation solution, but it's the deconsolidation solution.
Many small
airlines? Airlines emerge from U.S. Airways, or five
mm-hmm.
airlines emerge from U.S. Airways. Airlines and smaller ones that think that they can manage, that they can figure out a profitable pattern, a pattern among a smaller geographic area or a pattern among kinds of planes that they're going to fly, kinds of routes that they're going to fly, kind of traveler that they're going to look
mm-hmm.
for. In other words, mimicking the new entrance into the market, which is where the activity is.
With small-scale operations. Elizabeth Warren, stand by. We have a caller who I think may want to speak to even a further extension of that. Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
I think something that's been missed here completely
mm-hmm.
and got U.S. Airways in a lot of trouble here is the growth of regional jets. And despite the fact that...
When you say regional jets, Bob, do you mean private jets or
small
airlines?
I'm talking about scheduled jets flown by various airlines, which are 50 to 70 seats at the moment.
Okay.
And the point of the matter is that you've got, in Boston as an example, U.S. Airways shuttle, and the Delta shuttle flying to New York, and in one case to Washington with large planes,
mm-hmm.
and you would say, well, the business isn't there, so therefore perhaps they should cut back. But
mm-hmm.
as a matter of fact, in the last 3 weeks, American Airlines has announced that they're going to start flying regional jets from Boston to New York, And Delta has announced that they're going to start flying regional jets from Boston to Washington.
I want to be sure I understand what's new here. U.S. Airways has already been flying jets in the region.
But they've been under restrictions from the pilots union as to how many they can fly.
So you're saying smaller jets.
Well, a 50-seat jets as opposed to 300-seat jets.
And can these be more profitable?
Absolutely.
And why is that?
The salaries are less for the crews, and they don't take as much money to operate, fuel and otherwise.
So, but the big airlines can't devolve down to these small jet sizes.
Oh, they certainly can, and certainly are with the Delta connection, which is in airlines owned by Delta or partially owned by Delta, or American Eagle, which is huge in Boston and Chicago.
So then, Bob, what are the implications of more small jets moving in on regional runs?
I think they're enormous. I think you're going to see them. I think it's going to be the fastest growth area in the airline business.
Bob, thanks for your call. Steve Lott, how about it? Are we going to see smaller jets, fewer passengers, lower pay for pilots not driving the big ones around the sky?
Well, you're right. I wouldn't say yes to all of the above, but I definitely think that regional jets, they have been a tremendous growth area and will continue to be. The caller was right. They are cheaper to operate in that you have to pay the pilots less, and the break-even point is significantly less. For example, one of U.S. Airways' problems is that they're flying aircraft that are too big for the market they serve.
Mm-hmm.
They may be flying to a small city in West Virginia with a 737 that has 120 seats, yet they're only filling 40 seats of that plane. As a result, they lose money on that flight. However, if they switch in a regional jet on that same route, they may make money because that jet only has 50 seats, and the break-even, what they call the break-even load factor, the amount of seats they need to fill, changes dramatically.
But we read that there are already hundreds of big passenger jets parked in the deserts of the Southwest because there's not enough business for them. How can they move to small jets when these big old jets are starving for work?
Well, many of those jets are already been paid for, and they're old, and they're just going to be retired. They're never going to see another flight again. I mean, it's really the regional jets that are going to take over a lot of this small flying. In fact, a key part of U.S. Airways' recovery strategy is increasing dramatically the number of regional jets they fly. Right now, they can only fly about 75 in their fleet. Their plan is to fly close to 300 small regional jets in their fleet. The big problem up to this point for many airlines has been conflict with labor. The pilots union doesn't allow, based on many contracts, the pilots union doesn't allow those airlines to fly, you know, many regional jets. They're worried about, you know, obviously pay rates and job security. So this definitely is, we're going to see increased amount of regional jets flying crisscrossing the country.
Jack Beatty, it sounds as though part of the answer may emerge here is a lot more smaller jets flying around and the people working on them making less money.
Yeah, and I hear that strain in this, and that means probably ununionized jobs, too. And that distresses me. I mean, restructuring in the manufacturing economy has meant a lot of that. What it's meant is the people who work in restructured, re-engineered industries often have their standard of living is lower. That's probably going to happen to people in the airline industry. It already has happened, really. I guess the question I will want to raise is, you know, we've just gone through an episode where we saw what happens when you focus a corporation's results just on the shareholder, when you just run the corporation for the stock price. Well, we saw that the stock price can be manipulated. But something similar is going on with this whole deregulation idea. We're running the economy for the consumer. Now, the consumer needs, God knows, needs a break, and everybody wants to pay the lowest possible fare. But sometimes that's not entirely consistent with maintaining industries and with maintaining, you know, middle-class lifestyles and standards of living.
But, Jack, doesn't lower fares also raise up the lifestyles, the quality of life of people who can fly and visit their relatives? Should people be unable to fly so that certain pilots can make $250,000 a year?
No, I don't say that, and I think that's one of the things that deregulation has done. I mean, when it was introduced before Congress, when people were talking about what was happening in intrastate airlines, a fellow from Texas said, yeah, when people drive up for a flight down here, you think they're going to leave the chicken coop on the car. Let's get those folks into the plane. I'm all for that. I'm just saying you can't have everything. And if you have an economy that's just run for the consumers and industries just for the stockholder— you're going to have a heck of a lot of instability within the industries.
Boy, this is a new kind of conversation post 2001, 2002, though, isn't it, Jack? Adam's on the line. Welcome, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I want to make a couple comments about your last caller addressing the use of regional jets as basically the answer to the industry.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about regional jets, and I know that there's been a lot of talk, and you guys have been talking about the scope clauses in a lot of the labor contracts with the major airline pilots.
That is, the pilots don't want smaller jets because they make less money when they fly them?
Well, that's not really the case. The issue, really, and it has been addressed, is job security.
Adam, what's your vantage point on this issue? Are you in the industry?
Yes, I am. I am a pilot for a major airline.
Oh, okay.
Now, and what I the thing that's happening now, and I don't think it's much different than what you really saw post deregulation.
Mm-hmm.
When you had the Icons and the Lorenzos basically dismantling airlines as they existed, taking assets and setting up, you know, basically another airline, and in doing so, removing jobs of thousands of people to pay others 20% on less than what they were making. Now, I can only speak for my airline, although I would venture to guess that it's probably the case for most airline pilots now, is we don't have a problem with the use of regional jets.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a problem with basically the management of different companies claiming force majeure in our contracts, and in doing so, laying off, in this case, 800 to 1,000 pilots on several of the major airlines, and then taking those jobs and handing them over to other pilots off the street who do make significantly less.
But when they go into bankruptcy, that's a lot more likely to happen, isn't it, Adam?
Well, that may be for some, but as you've discussed, you know, in a deregulated industry, the strong survive and the weak go away. And, you know, they have their questions. What does the government want? Do they want, in fact, have a deregulated industry where free market rules, or do they want to control it in such a way that they can introduce service or keep service in places that it just may not have been able to be profitable?
What do you want, Adam?
What I would like to see, you know, I mean, obviously, like anybody, I'd like to have some job security. I enjoy my job. It's been a little bit more difficult since 9/11, but I enjoy it. And I've been flying for, oh, gosh, at this point, 15 years.
So does that mean deregulation or regulation?
No, I want deregulation, and I firmly believe in deregulation. I firmly believe that free market society is a way for everything. I mean, I think you can make the same analogies between what's going on in the airlines with, say, long-distance telephones. You know, I mean, at one point, there were the monopolies. They broke them up, and the strong survived, and the weak have gone away.
Yeah, but, and some who looked strong have turned out to be weak.
Excuse me?
And some who looked strong have turned out to be weak, witness WorldCom.
That's true. And that's like you said, too, especially in the airline industry, it's a cyclical industry, and it matches a lot of cases of the economy. And if you look at what's happening right now go back, turn the page back to just after the Gulf War, the airline industry took a humongous hit because of the economy, because of oil prices, and then came out of it, and we're doing very, very well for a good 6 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
However, and this is where I really wonder about what exactly the government wants with this industry, U.S. Airways perennially have been huge, huge losers. And if you can't make money in the good times, you're not going to make it in the bad times. And we can all agree that times are not good now.
They're not good now. We've got a bankruptcy sitting right in front of us. Adam, happy flying. Thanks for calling in. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about U.S. airlines in trouble. Does the airline industry, what does it tell us about the viability of deregulation in the U.S. economy? And how much trouble can we blame on September 11th here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about U.S. airlines in trouble. Can you feel air travel changing in America? Should the U.S. public be bailing out U.S. airlines? And do you care about the structure of the U.S. travel industry, or is it all about the lowest fare for you and the rest be damned? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Toby's on the line. Hi, Toby. You're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if you or your guests could explain what is the nature of bankruptcy these days? I mean, U.S. Airways is in bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
They're still flying. They're still selling tickets. They're, I assume, charging exactly what they charged yesterday for their services. What does it mean to be in bankruptcy for the public, the shareholders? And along with that, what will happen to the, say, top dozen executives or board members in terms of their compensation, having run this airline into bankruptcy. No other airline is in bankruptcy, so they must have been asleep at the switch.
So here raises the issue of distrust of what's going on in corporate America right now and whether or not U.S. Airways is somehow using bankruptcy as a dodge. Toby, let me put that to Elizabeth Warren, a professor at Harvard Law School specializing in commercial bankruptcy law. Elizabeth Warren, I guess what happens to shareholders? We've already talked about service. It's supposed to go on, though with a little more doubt. And what happens to executives? Is there a punitive element to bankruptcy these days, I think, is what Toby's getting at.
Right. Well, the punitive element is directed toward the shareholders.
They're left with zilch.
That's
is that right?
Right. Bankruptcy is designed to do what it can for the creditors and to say the shareholders take the hindmost.
Mm-hmm.
They get whatever are the scraps that might be left at the table. And if we looked only at the history of what happens to large corporations when they go into bankruptcy, the answer is the shareholders end up with nothing or with pennies in return for their shares.
So they take a big hit. What about the executives?
Toby
says, do they pay somehow in reputation, in financial terms, in any terms, for their company going into bankruptcy?
In the last few years, I am astonished to point out that executives tend to make more money when their companies go into bankruptcy.
Why?
Many of them sign what are called retention bonuses that give them extra bucks for staying around while the company is in serious financial trouble, and even more money once they file for bankruptcy. The Delaware courts in particular are notorious right now, the Delaware bankruptcy courts, for approving bonuses to executives who have just filed for bankruptcy. So while the shareholders are taking it on the chin, the executives tend to do fairly well. Now, the argument that's always used is we got to keep these guys around because they really, really, really understand the business, and this is no time to be switching.
But it's often the same crew that brought us to bankruptcy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the argument often is, well, but those were the larger market forces. It's
right.
not their fault that 9/11 happened. It's not their fault that there's overcapacity in the whole industry. It's
so
not
is
their
there,
fault.
Is there any punitive element for the managers who bring a company to bankruptcy, or in the U.S. Airways case, an airline to bankruptcy?
The punitive element is there only slightly, and it's in the reputational cost.
Mm-hmm.
That is that it turns out that when you study over the past 25 years, companies, big publicly traded companies that go into bankruptcy, the managers tend to be replaced within 24 months of the bankruptcy filing on one side or the other, either just before the filing or just after the filing. And they tend not to get jobs in other big industries or in other big companies. That said, you could treat that as enough punishment or not. I should point out, however, that there is legislation that's now been introduced in Congress just before they adjourned for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
The Delahunt-Durbin bill actually would go back and look at the executive compensation in the 2 years before the bankruptcy filing and also put a stop or a large break, I should say, on whether or not retention bonuses could be given to these managers
in bankruptcy.
The company is in bankruptcy.
So the times, they may be a change. Elizabeth Warren, I know we have to lose you. Thank you so much for coming on tonight. It's been great
My
having
pleasure.
You. Elizabeth Warren is professor at Harvard Law School specializing in commercial bankruptcy law. We are joined now and happy to be by Rudy Maxa, expert in residence with The Savvy Traveler. He's based in Washington and follows the airline travel and industry from a consumer perspective all over the country and the world. Good evening and welcome, Rudy Maxa.
Nice to be with you.
It's good to have you. Rudy, we've talked before about the fallout from September 11th. Now we've got real financial and business fallout here. U.S. Airways is claiming bankruptcy, and more may be to come. What do you see on the horizon for U.S. consumers? Are they going to be taking it on the chin in terms of higher fares, fewer routes? What are the implications?
Well, most immediately in the case of U.S. Airways, fewer routes because they're going to have to pare down. There may be some airfare sales. But in the long run, taking the long view, airlines are going to have to figure out how to make money, which means they're going to have to lower some of their higher fares, the ones they used to rely on business travelers to pay in order to make a profit. And they may have to raise some of the lower fares, which are almost giveaways to those of us who buy advance purchase tickets, which, of course, is the majority of Americans who buy airline tickets. So, you know, we may see a slightly higher per-seat average, you know, a couple years out. But I don't think it's going to be anything that's going to shock anybody or change, change anybody's idea about traveling.
Does that mean, Rudy, that airlines have not been able to make up in volume for the bargain fares that they've offered to travelers?
That's right. I mean, if anybody's flown lately, and I've taken 91 flights since September 11th, and almost all of them have been, you know, there's no such thing as empty middle seat unless you visit the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
So there's a perception that, well, what's the problem with the airlines is, you know, they're all full. Of course, there are fewer flights flying, and they're charging cheaper fares. So while it looks like everything's fine, clearly it's not financially. Airlines are going to have to figure out how to get their costs under control, how to make traveling more attractive, as the low-fare carriers such as Southwest and JetBlue have, by simplifying fares and eliminating the Saturday night stayover. And I have a feeling in every major airline's boardrooms these days, they're trying to figure out how to change the cost structure so they can make money and win back passengers.
And you're describing that as pulling the business traveler's price down and the vacation or casual traveler's price up.
Exactly. I mean, there's, you know, Senator Fritz Hollins goes back to his home state of South Carolina often, and many months ago he was complaining about having to pay on U.S. Airways, by the way, to fly from Washington to Charleston, South Carolina, and back nearly $1,000. And he said, you know, what is this? Who's going to do this? And by the way, I've taken that flight with him by sheer chance. I wasn't traveling with him. We were seated a seat apart. And it was, and I presume still is, a small, cramped, you know, small plane.
$1,000 flight.
And it's not all that happy an experience.
Mm-hmm.
They're still charging that, U.S. Airways is. So, you know, when are they going to figure out that people aren't going to pay it? That maybe if they charge $250, several people might actually go to Charleston happily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when today you and I could fly from New York to London for $358 on British Airways, you know, plus tax.
Rudy, part of our conversation tonight has been about whether or not travelers, i.e. consumers, have paid their fair share in an era of low-cost fares. Is there some sense in which passengers have had the good fortune of taking undue advantage of an industry here?
Well, of course, it's the industry that sets the fares. It's not as if we can go up to the gate and bargain with them and say, yeah, if you drop another 30, I'll walk aboard.
Well, we've heard about that on the web, you know.
Well, on the web, certainly you can, but you pay a price. Mm-hmm. On Priceline.com, which I think you're referring to, you mm-hmm. don't know what airline you're going to fly.
Right.
You don't know what time you're leaving and how many stops you're going to make.
Mm-hmm.
So you are willing to give up some convenience and certainty to pay a lower price, and that's fine. That's what the free market's supposed to do. Having said that, I do think we have had incredibly cheap airfares if we were able to book ahead and there's a sale going on. So, yeah, we have had it real good. In fact, we still have it real good. Pardon my English. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've got great, great bargains in airfares today.
Mm-hmm. Jerry's on the line. Welcome, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi there. Yeah, I must say, as I've been listening to this conversation, I've been just sort of astounded by all the sort of the whining and everything going on here.
set us straight, Jerry.
Well, I've been flying Southwest a lot. And I haven't flown since 9/11, I have to say that. But my experience on Southwest is that they get you where you're going reliably and on time. And your experts can correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but I believe they have the best on-time performance record, and they have had that consistently for a number of years. I've never had a problem flying on Southwest, not, you know, with a flight being canceled or not being on time.
I haven't heard anybody whine about it, but you're saying, bravo, if that's the new model, bravo, you like it.
Right, and furthermore, you know, what they do is they treat their employees well. After 9/11, they had no layoffs, and I believe they're the only airline that did that. So they have employee loyalty. They treat their passengers equally, if not necessarily great. I mean, it's like a bus. You buy a ticket in advance. You show up. The earlier you show up, the more choice you get on your seat because they don't have advanced seating. And all this stuff about saying, you know, well, they need subsidies to make money and everything else. Well, look, Southwest charges low fares. They fly lots of flights. They go pretty much where I want to go, although, again, it's to the peripheral airports that are usually an hour out, but that's fine with me. And they make money.
And they're the only ones making money. Jerry, let's put it to Rudy Maxa. Rudy, do you share the view that the Southwest JetBlue kind of model is the future? And are you as sanguine about that as our caller, Jerry?
Well, I couldn't agree with Jerry more. Let me just say a couple things. First of all, their on-time record is good, but the name of the airline is also Southwest, and for most of their business history, they've served the Southwest where the weather is much nicer than it is, say, for an airline like American and or United, which has a hub in Chicago.
Not so many snow delays in Phoenix.
Right. Now, admitted Southwest has gotten has now reached up to, you know, New England and all kinds of places in Chicago where weather is a factor. However, the point is, as Jeff says, they go point to point. They don't have these hub systems that the major airlines decided would be the ideal for the future, that more people could travel to more places more easily if airlines could funnel them into a hub and then take them to where they really wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, also, the corporate culture of Southwest is very unique. Only JetBlue comes close. And I agree. I fly Southwest all the time, as I do all the other airlines. And even though it's cramped and you don't get a assigned seat, the corporate spirit of the employees is so infectious that people don't mind it. It's a party. They don't mind they only get a bag of peanuts and a plastic cup with a drink in it.
It's a happy bus. Steve Lott, let me put that to you. If Southwest Airlines is the model, do you think the big U.S. airlines are capable at the corporate culture level, at the service level of adapting and going this way?
Well, to some degree they are, but the question is, do they want to? Don Carty, again, CEO of American, recently told employees that he has no intent of, and his quote was, Walmarting the airline. He has no intention of copying Southwest, but on the other hand, he says we need to get our costs down. Many of the key factor for many of the largest airlines, for example, American and United, is capturing the business traveler, whether they're flying domestically or going internationally. Obviously, Southwest doesn't fly internationally, but many business travelers want to build up frequent flyer miles and have lounges in the airport and have many of these amenities. They want a meal on board, many of these things. So many business travelers traditionally never flew Southwest. Now, that's been changing over the past year or so just because the fares are so darn cheap. But many airlines, for example, you know, American and United, have no intention of trying to keep up with Southwest and follow their strategy.
Rudy, what do you think? Are we going to see the American flying public break into different classes here, where some people are happy to go on the Southwest Airlines bus style, Walmart style, as it were, tier, and others want the stewardess to tuck the napkin in?
Well, I don't know if it's so much class as necessity. I fly Southwest when I can fly Southwest, when their schedule fits mine, and I can fly to Providence and don't have to go into Logan in Boston for an early morning meeting. When I can fly to my hometown of Washington, D.C. and land at BWI, which is an hour away from my front door of my apartment in downtown D.C., as opposed to 11 minutes away for Washington National. So, the majors certainly know why Southwest is profitable. They only fly one kind of aircraft. They have better deals with their unions. They give them profit sharing, so maybe that allows them to do it and give them stock that's generally appreciated. So the lessons are not lost on the major airlines. They know why Southwest and why JetBlue make money. They can't duplicate it because they have so much invested in the hub system, and they want to offer so many different flights and places that more people will fly them. So I think it's really not – we won't see a different class structure. We'll see a business traveler who, if he or she – can afford to fly into BWI and take an hour to get downtown for a meeting in D.C., may do it because it's smart for the bottom line. But if you need to fly into Washington for a morning meeting and get back for an afternoon meeting in wherever you're flying from, you may very well have to fly into National, and Southwest doesn't do that.
And hope your big airline hasn't gone bankrupt. Rudy Maxa, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Rudy Maxa's expert in residence with The Savvy Traveler. And Steve Lott, thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Steve Lott is business editor for Aviation Daily. Jack Beatty, last word goes to you. Are you flying?
Come fly the friendly skies.
Yeah, they're friendly if you can stay solvent.
Yes, indeed.
Here's hoping that enough airlines can do that. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.